This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Grain Brain, the surprising truth about wheat, carbs, and sugar, your brain's silent killers. Written by David Perlmutter, MD. Read by Peter Ganim. Please refer to the PDF included with this audiobook for reference to all images, charts, and recipes. To my father, who at age 96 begins each day by getting dressed to see his patients, despite having retired more than a quarter century ago. Your brain weighs 3 pounds and has 100,000 miles of blood vessels, contains more neurons than there are stars in the Milky Way, is the fattest organ in your body, could be suffering this very minute without your having a clue. Introduction. Against the grain. Maintaining order rather than correcting disorder is the ultimate principle of wisdom. To cure disease after it has appeared is like digging a well when one feels thirsty, or forging weapons after the war has already begun. Nei Jing, 2nd century BC. If you could ask your grandparents or great-grandparents what people died from when they were growing up, you'd likely hear the words old age. Or you might learn the story of someone who got a nasty germ and passed away prematurely from tuberculosis, cholera, or dysentery. What you won't hear are things like diabetes, cancer, heart disease, and dementia. In fact, the last time old age could be listed on a death certificate was 1951. Since then, we've had to attribute the immediate cause of death to a single disease. Today, those single diseases tend to be the kind that go on and on in a chronic, degenerating state and involve multiple complications and symptoms that accumulate over time. Which is why 80 and 90-year-olds don't usually die from a specific ailment. Like an old house in ongoing disrepair, the materials weather and rust, the plumbing and electrical falter, and the walls begin to crack from tiny fissures you cannot see. Throughout the home's natural decline, you do the needed maintenance wherever necessary, but it will never be like new unless you tear the structure down and start over again. Each attempt at patching and fixing buys you more time, but eventually the areas in desperate need of a total remodel or complete replacement are everywhere. And, as with all things in life, the human body simply wears out. An enfeebling illness sets in and slowly progresses at an excruciating pace until the body finally goes kaput. This is especially true when it comes to brain disorders, including the most dreaded of them all, Alzheimer's disease. It's a modern medical boogeyman that's never far from the headlines. If there is one health worry that seems to eclipse all others as people get older, it's falling prey to Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia that leaves you unable to think, reason, and remember. Research shows how deep this angst runs. In 2011, a study conducted by Harris Interactive for the MetLife Foundation showed that 31% of people fear dementia more than death or cancer. And this fear doesn't just affect older people. There are plenty of perpetual myths about the basket of brain-degenerating maladies that includes Alzheimer's. It's in the genes, it's inevitable with age, and it's a given if you live into your 80s and beyond. Not so fast. I'm here to tell you that the fate of your brain is not in your genes. It's not inevitable. And if you're someone who suffers from another type of brain disorder, such as chronic headaches, depression, epilepsy, or extreme moodiness, the culprit may not be encoded in your DNA. It's in the food you eat. Yes, you heard that right. Brain dysfunction starts in your daily bread, and I'm going to prove it. I'll state it again because I realize it sounds absurd. Modern grains are silently destroying your brain. By modern, I'm not just referring to the refined white flours, pastas, and rice that have already been demonized by the anti-obesity folks. I'm referring to all the grains that so many of us have embraced as being healthful. Whole wheat, whole grain, multigrain, seven grain, live grain, stone ground, and so on. Basically, I am calling what is arguably our most beloved dietary staple, a terrorist group that bullies our most precious organ, the brain. I will demonstrate how fruit and other carbohydrates could be health hazards with far-reaching consequences that not only will wreak physical havoc on your brain, but also will accelerate your body's aging process from the inside out. This isn't science fiction. It's now documented fact. It is my objective in writing Grain Brain to provide information that is sound and based on evolutionary, modern scientific, and physiological perspectives. This book goes outside the box of the layman's accepted dogma and away from vested corporate interests. It proposes a new way of understanding the root cause of brain disease and offers a promising message of hope. Brain disease can be largely prevented through the choices you make in life. So, if you haven't figured it out by now, I'll be crystal clear. This is not just another diet book or generic how-to guide to all things preventive health. This is a game changer. Every day, we hear about something new in our various wars against chronic disease, particularly with regard to illnesses that are predominantly avoidable through lifestyle habits. You'd have to be living under a rock not to know that we are getting fatter and fatter every year, despite all the information sold to us about how to stay slim and trim. You'd also be hard-pressed to find someone who doesn't know about our soaring rates of type 2 diabetes, or the fact that heart disease is our number one killer, trailed closely by cancer. Eat your vegetables, brush your teeth, sweat once in a while, get plenty of rest, don't smoke, laugh more. There are certain tenets to health that are pretty commonsensical and that we all know we should practice routinely. But somehow, when it comes to preserving our brain's health and mental faculties, we tend to think it's not really up to us, that somehow it's our destiny to develop brain disorders during our prime and grow senile in our elder years, or that we'll escape such a fate through the luck of good genes or medical breakthroughs. Certainly, we would probably do well to stay mentally engaged after retirement, complete crossword puzzles, keep reading, and go to museums. And it's not like there's a blatantly obvious, direct correlation between brain dysfunctions and specific lifestyle choices, as there is between, say, smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day and getting lung cancer, or gorging on French fries and becoming obese. Like I said, we have a habit of categorizing brain ailments separately from the other afflictions we attribute to bad habits. I'm going to change this perception by showing you the relationship between how you live and your risk of developing an array of brain-related problems, some that can strike when you're a toddler and others that get diagnosed at the other end of your lifespan. I believe that the shift in our diet that has occurred over the past century, from high-fat, low-carb to today's low-fat, high-carb diet, fundamentally consisting of grains and other damaging carbohydrates, is the origin of many of our modern scourges linked to the brain, including chronic headaches, insomnia, anxiety, depression, epilepsy, movement disorders, schizophrenia, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and those senior moments that quite likely herald serious cognitive decline and full-blown, irreversible, untreatable, and incurable brain disease. I'll reveal to you the profound effect that grains could be having on your brain right now without your even sensing it. The idea that our brains are sensitive to what we eat has been quietly circulating in our most prestigious medical literature recently. This information begs to be known by the public, which is increasingly duped by an industry that sells foods commonly thought of as nutritious. It also has led doctors and scientists like me to question what we consider to be healthy. Are carbohydrates and processed polyunsaturated vegetable oils such as canola, corn, cottonseed, peanut, safflower, soybean, and sunflower to blame for our soaring rates of cardiovascular disease, obesity, and dementia? Is a high saturated fat and high cholesterol diet actually good for the heart and brain? Can we really change our DNA with food despite the genes we've inherited? It's fairly well known now that a small percentage of the population's digestive systems are sensitive to gluten, the protein found in wheat, barley, and rye. But is it possible for virtually everyone's brain to have a negative reaction to this ingredient? Questions like these really began to bother me a few years ago as damning research started to emerge while my patients got sicker. As a practicing neurologist who cares day in and day out for individuals searching for answers to debilitating brain conditions, as well as families struggling to cope with the loss of a loved one's mental faculties, I'm compelled to get to the bottom of this. Perhaps it's because I'm not just a board-certified neurologist, but also a fellow of the American College of Nutrition, the only doctor in the country with both of these credentials. I'm also a founding member and fellow of the American Board of Integrative and Holistic Medicine. This enables me to have a unique perspective on the relationship between what we eat and how our brains function. This is not well understood by most people, including doctors who were educated years before this new science was established. It's time we paid attention. It's time someone like me came out from behind the microscope and the door to the clinical exam room and, frankly, blew the whistle. After all, the statistics are astounding. For starters, diabetes and brain disease are this country's costliest and most pernicious diseases, yet they are largely preventable and are uniquely tied together. Having diabetes doubles your risk for Alzheimer's disease. In fact, if there's one thing this book clearly demonstrates, it's that many of our illnesses that involve the brain share common denominators. Diabetes and dementia may not seem related at all, but I'm going to show you just how close every one of our potential brain dysfunctions is to conditions that we rarely attribute to the brain. I'm also going to draw surprising connections between vastly different brain disorders, such as Parkinson's and a propensity to engage in violent behavior, that point to root causes for an array of afflictions that involve the brain. While it's well established that processed foods and refined carbohydrates have contributed to our challenges with obesity and so-called food allergies, no one has explained the relationship between grains and other ingredients and brain health, and in the broader outlook, DNA. It's pretty straightforward. Our genes determine not just how we process food, but more important, how we respond to the foods we eat. There is little doubt that one of the largest and most wide-reaching events in the ultimate decline of brain health in modern society has been the introduction of wheat grain into the human diet. While it's true that our Neolithic ancestors consumed minuscule amounts of this grain, what we now call wheat bears little resemblance to the wild einkorn variety that our forebears consumed on rare occasion. With modern hybridization and gene-modifying technology, the 133 pounds of wheat that the average American consumes each year shares almost no genetic, structural, or chemical likeness to what hunter-gatherers might have stumbled upon. And therein lies the problem. We are increasingly challenging our physiology with ingredients for which we are not genetically prepared. For the record, this is not a book about celiac disease, a rare autoimmune disorder that involves gluten but only affects a small number of people. If you're already thinking that this book isn't for you because, one, you haven't been diagnosed with any condition or disorder, or two, you're not sensitive to gluten as far as you know, I implore you to listen on. This is about all of us. Gluten is what I call a silent germ. It can inflict lasting damage without your knowing it. Beyond calories, fat, protein, and micronutrients, we now understand that food is a powerful epigenetic modulator, meaning it can change our DNA for better or worse. Indeed, beyond simply serving as a source of calories, protein, and fat, food actually regulates the expression of many of our genes. And we have only just begun to understand the damaging consequences of wheat consumption from this perspective. Most of us believe that we can live our lives however we choose, and then, when medical problems arise, we can turn to our doctors for a quick fix in the form of the latest and greatest pill. This convenient scenario fosters an illness-centered approach on the part of physicians as they play their role as the purveyor of pills. But this approach is tragically flawed on two counts. First, it is focused on illness, not wellness. Second, the treatments themselves are often fraught with dangerous consequences. As an example, a recent report in the prestigious Archives of Internal Medicine revealed that postmenopausal women who were put on statin drugs to lower their cholesterol had a nearly 48% increased risk of developing diabetes compared to those who weren't given the drug. This one example becomes even more critical when you consider that becoming diabetic doubles your risk for Alzheimer's disease. These days, we are seeing an ever-increasing public awareness of the effects of lifestyle choices on health as well as disease risk. We often hear of the HeartSmart diet or recommendations to increase dietary fiber as a strategy to reduce colon cancer risk. But why is precious little information made available about how we can keep our brains healthy and stave off brain diseases? Is it because the brain is tied to the ethereal concept of the mind, and this erroneously distances it from our ability to control it? Or is it that pharmaceutical companies are invested in discouraging the idea that lifestyle choices have a profound influence on brain health? Fair warning, I'm not going to have kind things to say about our pharmaceutical industry. I know far too many stories of people abused by it than helped by it. You'll be hearing some of these stories in the pages ahead. This book is about those lifestyle changes you can make today to keep your brain healthy, vibrant, and sharp, while dramatically reducing your risk for debilitating brain disease in the future. I have dedicated more than 35 years to the study of brain diseases. My workday centers on creating integrative programs designed to enhance brain function in those afflicted with devastating disease. On a daily basis, I meet with families and other loved ones whose lives have been turned upside down by illness. It's heart-wrenching for me as well. Each morning before I start my day, I visit with my 96-year-old father, a former brilliant neurosurgeon trained at the prestigious Leahy Clinic. He now resides in an assisted living facility located across the parking lot from my office. While he may or may not remember my name, he almost never forgets to tell me to make sure I make rounds on each of his patients. He retired more than 25 years ago. The information that I will reveal to you is not just breathtaking. It's undeniably conclusive. You'll be shifting how you eat immediately, and you'll be looking at yourself in a whole new light. Right about now, you might be asking, is the damage already done? Have you doomed your brain from all those years of having your cake and eating it too? Don't panic. More than anything, I intend this book to be empowering, equipping you with a remote control to your future brain. It's all about what you do from this day forward. Drawing on decades of clinical and laboratory studies, including my own, as well as extraordinary results I've seen over the past 3 decades in my practices, I'll tell you what we know and how we can take advantage of this knowledge. I'll also offer a comprehensive action plan to transform your cognitive health and add more vibrant years to your life. And the benefits don't stop at brain health. I can promise that this program can help any of the following: ADHD, anxiety and chronic stress, chronic headaches and migraines, depression, diabetes, epilepsy, focus and concentration problems, inflammatory conditions and diseases, including arthritis, insomnia, intestinal problems including celiac, gluten sensitivity, and irritable bowel, memory problems, and mild cognitive impairment, frequently a precursor to Alzheimer's disease, mood disorders, overweight and obesity, Tourette's syndrome, and much more. Even if you don't suffer from any of the above conditions, this book can help you preserve your well-being and mental acuities. It is for both the old and the young, including women who plan to become or are pregnant. As I write this introduction, yet another study has emerged showing that babies born to women who are sensitive to gluten live with an increased risk of developing schizophrenia and other psychiatric disorders later in life. That's a huge, chilling finding that all expectant moms need to know. I've seen dramatic turnarounds in health, such as the 23-year-old man whose crippling tremors vanished after a few easy changes to his diet, and the countless case studies of epileptic patients whose seizures ended the day they replaced grains with more fats and protein, or the 30-something woman who experienced an extraordinary transformation in her health after suffering from a litany of medical challenges. Before coming to see me, she not only experienced crushing migraines, depression, and heartbreaking infertility, but also had a rare condition called dystonia that contorted her muscles into strange positions and nearly incapacitated her. Thanks to a few simple dietary tweaks, she allowed her body and brain to recover back to perfect health and a perfect pregnancy. These stories speak for themselves and are emblematic of millions of other stories of people who live with unnecessary life-depleting conditions. I see a lot of patients who have tried everything and who have had every neurological exam or scan available to them in the hope of finding a cure for their condition. With a few simple prescriptions that don't involve drugs, surgery, or even talk therapy, the vast majority of them heal and find a path back to health. You'll find all of these prescriptions in this book. A brief note about the book's organization. I've divided the material into three parts, starting with a comprehensive questionnaire designed to show you how your daily habits might be affecting the function and long-term health of your brain. Part 1, The Whole Grain Truth, takes you on a tour of your brain's friends and enemies, the latter of which render you vulnerable to dysfunction and disease. Turning the classic American food pyramid upside down, I'll explain what happens when the brain encounters common ingredients like wheat, fructose, the natural sugar found in fruit, and certain fats, proving that an extremely low-carbohydrate but high-fat diet is ideal. We're talking no more than 60 grams of carbs a day, the amount in a serving of fruit. This may also sound preposterous, but I'll be recommending that you start swapping out your daily bread with butter and eggs. You'll soon be consuming more saturated fat and cholesterol and rethinking the aisles in your grocery store. Anybody who's already been diagnosed with high cholesterol and prescribed a statin will be in for a rude awakening. I'm going to explain what's really going on in your body and tell you how to remedy this condition easily, deliciously, and without drugs. In compelling detail, backed by science, I'll put a new spin on the topic of inflammation, showing you that in order to control this potentially deadly biochemical reaction that lies at the heart of brain disease, not to mention all of our degenerative illnesses from head to toe, your diet will need to change. I'll show you how your food choices can bring inflammation under control by actually changing the expression of your genes. And it's pointless to consume antioxidants. Instead, we need to eat ingredients that turn on the body's own powerful antioxidant and detoxification pathways. Part 1 includes an exploration of the latest research on how we can change our genetic destiny and actually control the master switches in our DNA. The research is so captivating that it will inspire the most exercise-averse fast food junkie. Part 1 ends with a more in-depth look at some of our most pernicious psychological and behavioral disorders, such as ADHD and depression, as well as headaches. I'll explain how many cases can be remedied without drugs. In part two, Grain Brain Rehab, I present the science behind the habits that support a healthy brain, which includes three primary areas: nutrition and supplements, exercise, and sleep. The lessons gained in this part will help you execute my month-long program outlined in part three, Say Goodbye to Grain Brain. Included are menu plans, recipes, and weekly goals. For additional support and ongoing updates, you can go to my website at www.drperlmutter.com. There, you'll be able to access the latest studies, read my blog, and download materials that will help you tailor the information in this book to your personal preferences. For example, you'll find a day-at-a-glance and month-at-a-glance calendar with ideas on how to create your meals and plan your day, recipes included. Some of the lists in this book, for example, unexpected sources of gluten, will also be accessible online, so they will be easy to pin up in your kitchen or on your refrigerator as a reminder. So exactly what is Grain Brain? I think you already have a clue. It can best be understood by reflecting back on an old news bulletin. If you were paying attention to advertising in the mid-1980s, you might recall the public service announcements for a large-scale anti-narcotics campaign that featured an egg in a frying pan with the memorable tagline, "This is your brain on drugs." The powerful image suggested that the effect of drugs on the brain was like that of a hot pan on an egg. Sizzle, sizzle. This pretty much sums up my assertion about our brains on grains. Let me prove it to you. Then it's up to you to decide if you'll take this all seriously and welcome a brighter, more disease-free future. We've all got a lot to lose if we don't heed this message, and a lot to gain if we do. Self-assessment. What are your risk factors? We tend to think of brain disease as something that can strike us at any time, for no good reason other than genetic predisposition. Unlike heart disease, which progresses over time due to a combination of certain genetic and lifestyle factors, brain ailments seem like conditions that befall us by chance. Some of us escape them, while others become afflicted. But this thinking is wrong. Brain dysfunction is really no different from heart dysfunction. It develops over time through our behaviors and habits. On a positive note, this means we can consciously prevent disorders of our nervous system and even cognitive decline, much in the way we can stave off heart disease, by eating right and getting our exercise. The science now tells us, in fact, that many of our brain-related illnesses, from depression to dementia, are closely related to our nutritional and lifestyle choices. Yet only 1 in 100 of us will get through life without any mental impairment, let alone a headache or two. Before I delve into the science behind the bold statement that brain disorders often reflect poor nutrition, as well as a lot of other aggressive assertions, let's start with a simple questionnaire that reveals what habits could be silently harming you right now. The goal of the following questionnaire is to gauge your risk factors for current neurological problems, which can manifest in migraines, seizures, mood and movement disorders, sexual dysfunction, and ADHD, as well as for serious mental decline in the future. Respond to these statements as honestly as possible. Don't think about the connections to brain disease implied by my statements, just respond truthfully. In upcoming chapters, you'll begin to understand why I used these particular statements and where you stand in your risk factors. Note that if you feel like you're in between true and false and would answer sometimes, then you should choose true. 1. I eat bread, any kind. 2. I drink fruit juice, any kind. 3. I have more than one serving of fruit a day. 4. I choose agave over sugar. 5. I don't get out of breath on my daily walk. 6. My cholesterol is below 150. 7. I have diabetes. 8. I am overweight. 9. I eat rice, pasta, cereal, any kind. 10. I drink milk. 11. I don't exercise regularly. 12. Neurological conditions run in my family. 13. I don't take a vitamin D supplement. 14. I eat a low-fat diet. 15. I take a statin. 16. I avoid high cholesterol foods. 17. I drink soda, diet or regular. 18. I don't drink wine. 19. I drink beer. 20. I eat cereal. A perfect score on this test would be a whopping 0 true answers. If you answered true to one question, your brain and your entire nervous system is at greater risk for disease and disorder than if you scored a 0. And the more trues you tallied up, the higher your risk. If you scored more than a 10, you're putting yourself into the hazard zone for serious neurological ailments that can be prevented but cannot necessarily be cured once you are diagnosed. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. What are my risks? It's a question I am asked countless times every day. The great news is that we now have the means to medically profile individuals to determine their risk for developing certain diseases, from Alzheimer's to obesity, which is now a well-documented risk factor for brain disease, and to follow them along their journey to mark their progress. The laboratory studies listed ahead are available today, are economical, and are generally covered by most insurance plans. You'll learn more about these tests in later chapters, as well as ideas for improving your results, your numbers. The reason I list them here, however, is that many of you want to know right away what tests your doctor can perform that will help you get a true sense of your risk factors for brain disease. Don't hesitate to bring this list with you to your next doctor's visit and request the following lab work. Fasting blood glucose. A commonly used diagnostic tool to check for prediabetes and diabetes, this test measures the amount of sugar, glucose, in your blood after you have not eaten for at least 8 hours. A level between 70 and 100 milligrams per deciliter is considered normal. Above this, your body is showing signs of insulin resistance and diabetes and an increased risk for brain disease. Hemoglobin A1C. Unlike a test of blood sugar, this test reveals an average blood sugar over a 90-day period and provides a far better indication of overall blood sugar control. Because it can indicate the damage done to brain proteins due to blood sugar, something called glycated hemoglobin, it's one of the greatest predictors of brain atrophy. Fructosamine. Similar to the hemoglobin A1C test, a fructosamine test is used to measure an average blood sugar level, but over a shorter time period, the past 2 to 3 weeks. Fasting insulin. Long before blood sugar begins to climb as a person becomes diabetic, the fasting insulin level will rise, indicating that the pancreas is working overtime to deal with the excess of dietary carbohydrate. It is a very effective early warning system for getting ahead of the diabetes curve, and so has tremendous relevance for preventing brain disease. Homocysteine. Higher levels of this amino acid, produced by the body, are associated with many conditions, including atherosclerosis, narrowing and hardening of the arteries, heart disease, stroke, and dementia. It can often be easily lowered with specific B vitamins. Vitamin D. This is now recognized as a critical brain hormone. It's not a vitamin. C-reactive protein, CRP. This is a marker of inflammation. Cyrex array 3. This is the most comprehensive marker of gluten sensitivity available. Cyrex array 4, optional. This measures sensitivity to 24 cross-reactive foods to which a gluten-sensitive individual may also react. Even if you don't choose to have these tests done today, having a general understanding of them and what they mean will help you embrace the principles of Grain Brain. I will be referring to these tests and their implications throughout the book. Part 1. The Whole Grain Truth. If the thought of your brain suffering over a bowl of savory pasta or a plate of sweet French toast seems far-fetched, brace yourself. You probably already knew that processed sugar and carbs weren't all that great for you, especially in excess. But so-called healthy carbohydrates like whole grains and natural sugars? Welcome to the Whole Grain Truth. In this part, we're going to explore what happens when the brain is bombarded by carbohydrates, many of which are packed with inflammatory ingredients like gluten that can irritate your nervous system. The damage can begin with daily nuisances like headaches and unexplained anxiety, and progress to more sinister disorders such as depression and dementia. We'll also look at the role common metabolic challenges like insulin resistance and diabetes play in neurological dysfunction, and see how we likely owe our obesity and Alzheimer's epidemics to our undying love for carbs and stark disdain for fat and cholesterol. By the end of this part, you'll have a new appreciation for dietary fat and an educated apprehension when it comes to most carbohydrates. You'll also learn that there are things you can do to spur the growth of new brain cells, gain control of your genetic destiny, and protect your mental faculties. Chapter 1. The Cornerstone of Brain Disease. What You Don't Know About Inflammation. The chief function of the body is to carry the brain around. Thomas A. Edison. Imagine being transported back to the Paleolithic era of early humans who lived in caves and roamed the savannas tens of thousands of years ago. Pretend for a moment that language is not a barrier and you can communicate easily. You have the opportunity to tell them what the future is like. From a cross-legged perch on a dirt floor in front of a warm fire, you start by describing the wonders of our high-tech world, with its planes, trains, and automobiles, city skyscrapers, computers, televisions, smartphones, and the information highway that is the Internet. Humans have already traveled to the moon and back. At some point, the conversation moves to other lifestyle topics and what it's like to really live in the 21st century. You dive into describing modern medicine with its stupendous array of drugs to treat problems and combat diseases and germs. Serious threats to survival are few and far between. Not many people need to worry about crouching tigers, famine, and pestilence. You explain what it's like to shop at grocery stores and supermarkets, a totally foreign concept to these individuals. Food is plentiful. And you mention things like cheeseburgers, french fries, soda, pizza, bagels, bread, cinnamon rolls, pancakes, waffles, scones, pasta, cake, chips, crackers, cereal, ice cream, and candy. You can eat fruit all year long and access virtually any kind of food at the touch of a button or just a short drive away. Water and juice come in bottles for transportability. Although you try to avoid brand names, it's hard to resist because they have become such a part of life. Starbucks, Wonder Bread, Pepperidge Farm, Pillsbury, Lucky Charms, Skittles, Domino's, Subway, McDonald's, Gatorade, Häagen-Dazs, Cheerios, Yoplait, Cheez-It, Coke, Hershey's, and Budweiser. They are in awe, barely able to picture this future. Most of the features you chronicle are unfathomable. They can't even visualize a fast food restaurant or bread bar. The term junk food is impossible to put into words these people understand. Before you can even begin to mention some of the milestones that humans had to achieve over millennia, such as farming and herding, and later food manufacturing, they ask about the challenges modern people deal with. The obesity epidemic, which has gotten so much attention in your media lately, comes first to mind. This isn't an easy matter for their lean and toned bodies to grasp, and neither is your account of the chronic illnesses that plague society. Heart disease, diabetes, depression, autoimmune disorders, cancer, and dementia. These are totally unfamiliar to them, and they ask a lot of questions. What is an autoimmune disorder? What causes diabetes? What is dementia? At this point, you're speaking a different language. In fact, as you give them a rundown of what kills most people in the future, doing your best to define each condition, you are met with looks of confusion and disbelief. You've painted a beautiful, exotic picture of the future in these people's minds, but then you tear it down with causes of death that seem to be more frightening than dying from an infection or being eaten by a predator higher up on the food chain. The thought of living with a chronic condition that slowly and painfully leads to death sounds awful. And when you try to convince them that ongoing degenerative disease is possibly the trade-off for potentially living much longer than they do, your prehistoric ancestors don't buy it. And, soon enough, neither do you. Something seems wrong with this picture. As a species, we are genetically and physiologically identical to these humans that lived before the dawn of agriculture. And we are the product of an optimal design, shaped by nature over thousands of generations. We may not call ourselves hunters and gatherers anymore, but our bodies certainly behave as such from a biological perspective. Now, let's say that during your time travel back to the present day, you begin to ponder your experience with these ancestors. It's easy to marvel at how far we've come from a purely technological standpoint, but it's also a no-brainer to consider the struggles that millions of your contemporary comrades suffer needlessly. You may even feel overwhelmed by the fact that preventable, non-communicable diseases account for more deaths worldwide today than all other diseases combined. This is tough to swallow. Indeed, we may be living longer than our ancient relatives, but we could be living much better, enjoying our lives sickness-free, especially during the second half of life when the risk of illness rises. While it's true that we are living longer than previous generations, most of our gains are due to improvements in infant mortality and child health. In other words, we've gotten better at surviving the accidents and illnesses of childhood. We haven't, unfortunately, gotten better at preventing and combating illnesses that strike us when we're older. And while we can certainly make a case for having much more effective treatments now for many illnesses, that still doesn't erase the fact that millions of people suffer needlessly from conditions that could have been avoided. When we applaud the average life expectancy in America today, we shouldn't forget about quality of life. When I was in medical school decades ago, my education revolved around diagnosing disease and knowing how to treat, or in some cases, cure each disease with a drug or other therapy. I learned how to understand symptoms and arrive at a solution that matched those symptoms. A lot has changed since then, because we are not only less likely to encounter easily treatable and curable illnesses, but also better able to understand many of our modern chronic diseases through the lens of a common denominator, inflammation. So, rather than spotting infectious diseases and addressing sicknesses with known culprits, such as germs, viruses, or bacteria, doctors are faced with myriad conditions that don't have clear-cut answers. I can't write a prescription to cure someone's cancer, vanquish inexplicable pain, instantly reverse diabetes, or restore a brain that's been washed away by Alzheimer's disease. I can certainly try to mask or lessen symptoms and manage the body's reactions, but there's a big difference between treating an illness at its root and just keeping symptoms at bay. Now that one of my own kids is in medical school, I see how times have changed in teaching circles. Doctors in training are no longer taught just how to diagnose and treat. They are equipped with ways of thinking that help them to address today's epidemics, many of which are rooted in inflammatory pathways run amok. Before I get to the connection between inflammation and the brain, let's consider what I think is arguably one of the most monumental discoveries of our era. The origin of brain disease is in many cases predominantly dietary. Although several factors play into the genesis and progression of brain disorders, to a large extent, numerous neurological afflictions often reflect the mistake of consuming too many carbs and too few healthy fats. The best way to comprehend this truth is to consider the most dreaded neurological ailment of all, Alzheimer's, and view it within the context of a type of diabetes triggered by diet alone. We all know that poor diet can lead to obesity and diabetes, but a busted brain? Alzheimer's disease. Type 3 diabetes? Flashback to your moment with those hunters and gatherers. Their brains are not too different from yours. Both have evolved to seek out foods high in fat and sugar. After all, it's a survival mechanism. The problem is that your hunting efforts end quickly because you live in the age of plenty and you're more likely to find processed fats and sugars. Your caveman counterparts are likely to spend a long time searching, only to come across fat from animals and natural sugar from plants and berries if the season is right. So while your brain might operate similarly, your sources of nutrition are anything but. In fact, these are the main differences between our diet and that of our forebears. Your ancestors' diet. Carbs, 5%. Protein, 20%. Fat, 75%. Diet recommended by U.S. experts. Carbs, 60%. Protein, 20%. Fat, 20%. And what exactly does this difference in dietary habits have to do with how well we age and whether or not we suffer from a neurological disorder or disease? Everything. The studies describing Alzheimer's as a third type of diabetes began to emerge in 2005, but the link between poor diet and Alzheimer's has only recently been brought to light with newer studies showing how this can happen. These studies are both convincingly horrifying and empowering at the same time. To think we can prevent Alzheimer's just by changing the food we eat is, well, astonishing. This has many implications for preventing not just Alzheimer's disease, but all other brain disorders, as you'll soon discover in the upcoming chapters. But first, a brief lesson on what diabetes and the brain have in common. Evolutionarily, our bodies have designed a brilliant way to turn the fuel from food into energy for our cells to use. For almost the entire existence of our species, glucose, the body's major source of energy for most cells, has been scarce. This pushed us to develop ways to store glucose and convert other things into it. The body can manufacture glucose from fat or protein if necessary, through a process called gluconeogenesis. But this requires more energy than the conversion of starches and sugar into glucose, which is a more straightforward reaction. The process by which our cells accept and utilize glucose is an elaborate one. The cells don't just suck up glucose passing by them in the bloodstream. This vital sugar molecule has to be allowed into the cell by the hormone insulin, which is produced by the pancreas. Insulin, as you may already know, is one of the most important biological substances for cellular metabolism. Its job is to ferry glucose from the bloodstream into muscle, fat, and liver cells. Once there, it can be used as fuel. Normal, healthy cells have a high sensitivity to insulin, but when cells are constantly exposed to high levels of insulin as a result of a persistent intake of glucose, much of which is caused by an overconsumption of hyperprocessed foods filled with refined sugars that spike insulin levels beyond a healthy limit, our cells adapt by reducing the number of receptors on their surfaces to respond to insulin. In other words, our cells desensitize themselves to insulin, causing insulin resistance, which allows the cells to ignore the insulin and fail to retrieve glucose from the blood. The pancreas then responds by pumping out more insulin. So higher levels of insulin become needed for sugar to go into the cells. This creates a cyclical problem that eventually culminates in type 2 diabetes. People with diabetes have high blood sugar because their body cannot transport sugar into cells where it can be safely stored for energy. And this sugar in the blood presents many problems, too many to mention. Like a shard of glass, the toxic sugar inflicts a lot of damage, leading to blindness, infections, nerve damage, heart disease, and yes, Alzheimer's. Throughout this chain of events, inflammation runs rampant in the body. I should also point out that insulin can be viewed as an accomplice to the events that unfold when blood sugar cannot be managed well. Unfortunately, insulin doesn't just escort glucose into our cells. It's also an anabolic hormone, meaning it stimulates growth, promotes fat formation and retention, and encourages inflammation. When insulin levels are high, other hormones can be affected adversely, either increased or decreased due to insulin's domineering presence. This, in turn, plunges the body further into unhealthy patterns of chaos that cripple its ability to recover its normal metabolism. Genetics are certainly involved in whether or not a person becomes diabetic, and genetics can also determine at what point the body's diabetes switch gets turned on, once its cells can no longer tolerate the high blood sugar. For the record, type 1 diabetes is a separate disease thought to be an autoimmune disorder, accounting for only 5% of all cases. People with type 1 diabetes make little or no insulin because their immune system attacks and destroys the cells in the pancreas that produce insulin, so daily injections of this important hormone are needed to keep blood sugars balanced. Unlike type 2, which is usually diagnosed in adults after their bodies have been abused by too much glucose over time, type 1 diabetes is typically diagnosed in children and adolescents. And unlike type 2, which is reversible through diet and lifestyle changes, there is no cure for type 1. That said, it's important to keep in mind that even though genes strongly influence the risk of developing type 1 diabetes, the environment can play a role too. It has long been known that type 1 results from both genetic and environmental influences, but the rising incidence over the last several decades has led some researchers to conclude that environmental factors could be more instrumental in the development of type 1 than previously thought. Sad, but true. More than 186,000 people younger than age 20 have diabetes, either type 1 or type 2. Just a decade ago, type 2 diabetes was known as adult-onset diabetes, but with so many young people being diagnosed, the term had to be dropped. And new science shows that the progression of the disease happens more rapidly in children than in adults. It's also more challenging to treat in the younger generation. What we're beginning to understand is that insulin resistance, as it relates to Alzheimer's disease, sparks the formation of those infamous plaques that are present in diseased brains. These plaques are the buildup of an odd protein that essentially hijacks the brain and takes the place of normal brain cells. And the fact that we can associate low levels of insulin with brain disease is why talk of type 3 diabetes is starting to circulate among researchers. It's all the more telling to note that obese people are at a much greater risk of impaired brain function, and that those with diabetes are at least twice as likely to develop Alzheimer's disease. This statement is not meant to imply that diabetes causes Alzheimer's disease, only that they both share the same origin. They both spring from foods that force the body to develop biological pathways leading to dysfunction and, farther down the road, illness. While it's true that someone with diabetes and another person with dementia may look and act differently, they have a lot more in common than we previously thought. In the last decade, we've witnessed a parallel rise in the number of type 2 diabetes cases and the number of people who are considered obese. Now, however, we're starting to see a pattern among those with dementia too, as the rate of Alzheimer's disease increases in sync with type 2 diabetes. I don't think this is an arbitrary observation. It's a reality we all have to face as we shoulder the weight of soaring healthcare costs and an aging population. New estimates indicate that Alzheimer's will likely affect 100 million people by 2050, a crippling number for our healthcare system and one that will dwarf our obesity epidemic. The prevalence of type 2 diabetes, which accounts for 90 to 95% of all diabetes cases in the United States, has tripled in the past 40 years. No wonder the U.S. government is anxiously looking to researchers to improve the prognosis and avert this catastrophe. And in the next 40 years, more than 115 million new cases of Alzheimer's are expected globally, costing us more than $1 trillion in today's dollars. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 18.8 million Americans were diagnosed with diabetes in 2010, and another 7 million went undetected. Between 1995 and 2010, the number of diagnosed cases of diabetes jumped by 50% or more in 42 states, and by 100% or more in 18 states. The silent brain on fire. One of the most frequent questions I get at my clinic from families of Alzheimer's patients is, how did this happen? What did my mother or father, brother, sister do wrong? I am careful how I respond at such a heartbreaking time in a family's life. Watching my own father wither away slowly day after day is a constant reminder of the mixed emotions that a family endures. There is frustration fused with helplessness and anguish mingled with regret. But if I had to tell family members, myself included, the absolute truth given what we know today, I'd say that their loved one may have done one or more of the following. Lived with chronic high blood sugar levels even in the absence of diabetes. Eaten too many carbohydrates throughout his or her life. Opted for a low-fat diet that minimized cholesterol. Had undiagnosed sensitivity to gluten, the protein found in wheat, rye, and barley. When I tell people that gluten sensitivity represents the greatest and most under-recognized health threat to humanity, the response I hear is pretty much the same. You can't be serious. Not everyone is sensitive to gluten. Of course, if you have celiac disease, but that's a small number of people. And when I remind people that all the latest science points to the bane of gluten in triggering not just dementia, but epilepsy, headaches, depression, schizophrenia, ADHD, dementia, and even decreased libido, a common thread prevails in the response. I don't understand what you mean. They say this because all they knew about gluten focuses on intestinal health, not neurological wellness. We're going to get up close and personal with gluten in the next chapter. Gluten isn't just an issue for those with bona fide celiac disease, an autoimmune disorder that strikes a small minority. As many as 40% of us can't properly process gluten, and the remaining 60% could be in harm's way. The question we need to be asking ourselves, what if we're all sensitive to gluten from the perspective of the brain? Unfortunately, gluten is found not only in wheat products, but also in the most unsuspecting products, from ice cream to hand cream. Increasing numbers of studies are confirming the link between gluten sensitivity and neurological dysfunction. This is true even for people who have no problems digesting gluten and who test negative for gluten sensitivity. I see this every day in my practice. Many of my patients reach me once they have tried everything and have been to scores of other doctors in search of help. Whether it's headaches and migraines, Tourette's syndrome, seizures, insomnia, anxiety, ADHD, depression, or just some odd set of neurological symptoms with no definite label, one of the first things I do is prescribe the total elimination of gluten from their diets, and the results continue to astound me. Researchers have known for some time now that the cornerstone of all degenerative conditions, including brain disorders, is inflammation. But what they didn't have documented until now are the instigators of that inflammation, the first missteps that prompt this deadly reaction. And what they are finding is that gluten,